Good morning and welcome to the June 2nd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
And it should be a beautiful spring day, and it's a good opportunity for you to get your salt and lime out because we're going to start our show this morning by taking a shot at speaking with author Ted Genoways. His book is called Tequila Wars, Jose Cuervo and the Bloody Struggle for the Spirit of Mexico.
Yep, and then we'll speak with Kevin Jessup and Matthew Bartholomew of Mountain West Capital Network, and we'll finish our hour by speaking with Galen and Katie Zamara of Le Defoe Brasserie and Union Patisserie. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
The name Cuervo is inextricably tied to tequila. The story of how Jose Cuervo built his tequila empire against the backdrop of extraordinarily tumultuous times in Mexico is laid out in a new book, Tequila Wars, Jose Cuervo and the Bloody Struggle for the Spirit of Mexico. We're lucky to be joined this morning by Ted Genoways, author of the book. Good morning, Ted. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Ted, let's give our audience a little bit of background. What motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, let me just say that the research took long enough that I started to wonder what motivated me to do it as well. It took about 12 years from start to finish to write this book. That is not what I would have ever intended or expected. But it was kind of a passion project from the beginning. I often say that I started working on this book even before I was born. My dad is a biologist. He studies bats. And before I was born, he spent a number of years in the state of Jalisco, in central Mexico, where the city of Guadalajara and the Tequila Valley, where the town of Tequila sits. And he spent years in the agave fields netting bats and doing a population study there. And so when his book, The Bats of Jalisco, came out shortly after I was born, a number of those Mexican biologists would come and visit us and stay with us. And of course, when they arrived, they always came with a bottle in hand, and everyone would sit around in the evenings telling stories about their time together in the Tequila Valley. So from the time I was very young, this was a place that I wanted to see and get to know more about. My original idea back in 2013 was that I would just do a one-off magazine story, that would scratch that itch and that would be enough. And I think I've been in Jalisco and around some of the agave fields and the tequila distilleries for about 2 days when I thought, I actually want to write a book about this. And the reason it took 12 years is that instead of writing about the contemporary industry, I decided that what I was really interested in was the history of how this industry emerged and some of those famous names like Cuervo and Sousa that we see on bottles but don't necessarily know that they were even real people. And everybody told me there's no history there to be recovered. It's all lost. There's no way to get it back. The documents are destroyed. Everything is irrecoverable. And I guess I was just stubborn enough to not believe that that was true, but they weren't entirely wrong. I mean, it took me more than a decade to find all of these pieces and slowly assemble them into the story that exists now. It was a very slow and often painstaking process.
Now, how many bottles of tequila did you go through over those 12 years of research?
I couldn't even begin to count. I really couldn't. So I will say that when people say, you know, how did you keep going for more than a decade? Certainly one of the answers is that going and doing research in the tequila region has its benefits, mm-hmm. and especially showing up and talking to members of the old families who are still making tequila today. And often when you're there doing research and gathering stories and those sorts of things, some of the not just bottles will come out, but some of the really prized bottles, and so it has been a really fun experience for all of that time. Nice. No question.
So tequila comes from agave, the agave plant. Can you share a little bit about the agave plant and how the different plant affects the tequila?
Yeah, so this is a great place to start. The plant itself is a desert succulent. It's a huge plant with a bulb in the middle and these spiked leaves that stick out. They call them pincas in Mexico. It takes 7 to 10 years for that plant to mature. And it is a really difficult plant to cultivate and raise. Everything kills those plants off. They're susceptible to cold. They're susceptible to too much rain. They're susceptible to fungal infections and bacterial infections, and also to pests. So it's a really challenging plant to work with. But then at the end, when it reaches maturity, there are still skilled harvesters who go out and harvest the plants with hand tools, these razor sharp tools called coas, and they shear off the pincas and leave just the heart of the agave, what is called the piña, because it looks like a pineapple. And that plant is then brought in to the distillery, where it is baked to bring those sugars out, and then it is milled and then fermented, and then all of the it's not exactly juice, but it's what we think of as juice that comes out of that process that has fermented, is distilled a second time in order to produce the tequila and the flavor profiles that we know. There are also lots of different things to do after you've got your tequila. There's unaged tequila that's blanco. Then you've got various aged expressions. If it's left in just a few months, it's reposado. If it's left in a year, it's añejo. If it's left in for more time than that, it's extra añejo. And so the other thing that's amazing about this spirit is that there are a lot of different ways of interpreting it as well. And you'll find people who are hardcore Blanco drinkers, find people who are dedicated Reposado drinkers. It's all kind of intriguing. The additional thing that has emerged in like the last 10 years is enough of an aficionado crowd that there's more and more attention to the particular growing regions and to the particular families that are raising the agave and distilling. So you get real distinctions in flavor between the Tequila Valley, northwest of Guadalajara, and the kind of agave and distilling that you get in the highlands to the east of Guadalajara. Different elevation, different soil type, different amount of rainfall. It all produces differences in the flavors. And again, you'll find people who are like, you know, I am dedicated to drinking Blancos from the highlands, and other people who are like, no, it's got to be an Añejo from the valley. And so it's a fun world to sort of start to immerse into and slowly get to know. And as I said, you know, my particular interest was in the people who have been doing this for generations, and the way that those family networks have emerged and the way that they have shaped the industry over more than a century now.
Yeah. And as you go through the book, obviously the story of the plant is inextricably tied to the families that sort of decide to make this stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the Cuervo family and how they first get involved with the manufacture of tequila.
That's right. Yeah. So one of the things that's kind of incredible about the Cuervo family is that when they arrive in the Tequila Valley in the middle of the 18th century, they arrive there in order to be sort of the political chief of the region. And the very first thing that they do is apply for a license from the Crown of Spain at the time to be able to raise agave and to be able to distill what at the time was known as agave brandy. And that is how they arrive. It is what they are there to do from the very beginning. And as you say, everything about that intention sort of shapes the city and the development of the community. The landscape itself then also shapes the industry and the family. So they spend several generations trying to just acquire land and build their inventory of agave to be able to raise enough to be able to produce a quantity that you can take it to market. It's also a fascinating thing to me that at every turn, the history of Mexico really determines what happens with the whole tequila industry. From the beginning, the War of Independence as it's being fought, the rebels blockade the port at Acapulco, which forces the Spanish crown to build a new road from a different port in San Blas in order to be able to get supplies to Guadalajara. The route that they take through the mountains comes right through the plaza in Tequila. And that's the region or the reason that we know that particular kind of brandy or mezcal, it, as much as it is the flavor profile. It's suddenly there's a road that allows the barrels of tequila to be easily transported to Guadalajara, but they can also be transported by those same mule teams as they're going back to the coast and carry it up north into what was still, you know, northern Mexico at that time or to other Spanish holdings. And so always it's this change in the historical circumstances that keep molding and shaping the industry. But strangely, it always seems to kind of open an opportunity that the Cuervos are very adept at exploiting and finding a way to find an advantage out of it.
Yeah, so the term agave brandy, that is synonymous with mezcal?
Yeah, it really is. So the term, the original term was vino mezcal, which is like a mezcal wine. The mezcal, it refers to the plant itself. The agave, the indigenous term for that was mezcal. And you'll still hear that used kind of interchangeably, especially in rural areas where there are people who will talk about the mezcales. And so all that this was originally was saying, well, this is a wine or a brandy that is derived from these mezcal plants, from these agave plants. And soon tequila gained enough of a reputation that it had a kind of regional distinction. It was vino mezcal de tequila. And so over time, people would say, not that whole big mouthful, but simply tequila, that was the thing that they were looking for. And in time, as the production methods in the town of Tequila started to change in order to industrialize and produce more at quantity, and so instead of using in-ground ovens that create that smoky flavor that we associate with mezcal, it was being made in brick ovens and with steam heat, and suddenly using different kinds of stills that are more efficient and produce more alcohol. The flavor profile starts to change. And so it's not just a distinction in terms of region, but eventually it comes to describe a different set of flavors that people are looking for. And in general, the notion is that mezcal has a bit more, like I said, of that smoky and kind of rustic flavor, and tequila is a bit more of a refined product and something that can be used in cocktails.
Let's let Jose Cuervo himself enter the movie. Well, one of the things I liked about that struck me about the book was, you know, his career obviously spans a great deal of time and a great deal of tumult. But let's start with, how did his career in the business begin? And let's talk a little bit about how he came to be married and the significance of that marriage.
Yeah. So as you say, I mean, Cuervo came from a tequila-making family. His father and his uncle had made tequila, both on the south side of the volcano, the tequila volcano, where his uncle had a huge distillery, and on the north side where his father had a smaller distillery. As powerful as they were, they lost that empire when Cuervo was a teenager. And so when he came of age, he started working at an agave ranch that was owned by one of his uncles. And, you know, having grown up expecting to inherit an empire, I imagine it must have been fairly difficult to instead end up, you know, someplace where you're essentially a ranch manager and just making a daily living. But As it happened, that uncle who owned one of what was then the largest and is still the largest distillery in the country, stopped off at that ranch one night. He was impressed with how Cuervo was running the estate. And so when there was soon an opening for someone to manage his distillery in the town of Tequila, he decided that he would appoint Jose Cuervo to run the distillery. Again, things went well. He was impressed by Cuervo. And it's important to note that Jesus Flores, this uncle, was about 30 years older than his wife, Ana Gonzalez Rubio. And so when Flores was older and was on his deathbed, he legendarily called Ana to his bedside and said, you know, when I'm gone, you're going to need someone to run this business. And I think that my nephew, Jose Cuervo, would make for a good husband. And so Ana had it somewhere in her mind that that would be a good plan. It was more than 2 years after that that Cuervo continued to run the business, and Ana was the owner. But they were engaged in various projects, trying to get more access and especially trying to bring the railroad right to the door of the distillery in Tequila, with little success. So Ana called Jose to her mansion in Guadalajara and said, you know, I've been thinking about this, and you know, I think that the reason we can't get ahead with some of these projects is because people don't see you as the actual owner of the brand. And I think it's best for us to marry.
What a romantic proposal.
Right. Exactly. Right. But then such a strange thing that Cuervo himself, here's a young man who has an opportunity to kind of reclaim the empire that his family lost just as when he was a teenager. And Ana is, you know, the probably the richest woman in Jalisco at that point. She is the subject of kind of breathless columns in the society pages about her beauty and her elegance and her style. But in the face of this opportunity, Cuervo, who is always a very cautious and very sort of calculated figure, he tells Ana, you know, I'll get back to you. let me think about it. And so he went back to Tequila, spent a month there back at work and running the distillery when he got another message that Ana wanted to meet with him again. So he returned to Guadalajara and she said, you know, you've been very, very busy over the last month and you haven't had time to think about the proposal that I made to you. So I've thought about it for us. And in that instant, the justice of the peace entered the salon with his Bible and the two of them were married on the spot.
This was my favorite passage in the book, yeah. I must admit.
It's quite a story. I have to say, the thing that I always want to add to that story is that it's such an interesting union right from the beginning, because Ana is by law, she has to give up all of her property to her husband as soon as she's married. And so she has to give away this empire that she has inherited and has been running for several years in order for this union to be possible. And Jose Cuervo, he has been running this business. He is coming into this now, choosing basically the path that will determine the rest of his life and the shape of the industry going forward. And the two of them, first of all, I have to assume that there was some affection between the two of them. This is such a leap of faith for them both. But also, the two of them enter so quickly into making all kinds of aggressive business moves and making changes that there has to have been some thrill in the household as all of these things that they had each envisioned suddenly become possible now that there's this partnership between them. So it's an interesting and dynamic pair. Also, I mean, Cuervo is so shy and so retiring. He's a very good businessman, but he's very sort of unwilling to be this out front public figure. But Anna is, by all accounts, you know, she's putting on grand balls at the at their home and inviting all of the upper class of Guadalajara and making a lot of the political connections for them. So I do think that it's a partnership that is really valuable for both sides.
Yeah, and so you mentioned the railroad. Shortly after this, the railroad goes in?
Yeah, well, it takes a little while, but yeah, Cuervo gets the railroad brought into Tequila, and that becomes a really crucial thing. It not only brings the rail itself, but then the electricity is brought on towers that are erected in the easement along the tracks. And this also allows, you know, transport not only of the barrels back and forth, but of heavy equipment that can be brought in,
build more
steam boilers, you know, new distillation equipment. It really kind of modernizes the tequila industry more or less overnight.
Yeah. Now, what year are we talking about there?
That's 1909.
Gotcha.
And then we
had a very unsettled and violent time.
Well, this is the problem, is that poor Jose Cuervo, he spends the first 10 years running this business, building infrastructure, building all of these trade routes and you know, patenting new equipment, and gets everything in place in 1909. And sort of fall of 1909, everything is completely squared away. And then the Mexican Revolution starts in 1910. And so he then spends the next decade doing what he can to kind of play defense against all of the various forces. And at first it's an attempt to control all of this politically. It forces him more into a public role as a politician and power broker. But when that is unsuccessful, when the revolution just grows and gains momentum, and then eventually turns into not just, you know, one revolutionary front against the government power, but multiple revolutionary factions fighting against each other, it really becomes Cuervo just trying to survive, trying to keep his distilleries from being destroyed, keep the railroad tracks from being blown up, and often with not very much success. The revolutionaries are very fond of rolling into a town where there's a lot of money and a lot of weapons that's there to protect the money, and also a lot of tequila. It's kind of a good spot. If you're a revolutionary, it's a good spot to hit.
Yeah, it's a marriage made in heaven there.
Yeah, and the story is, obviously we can't summarize the number of dramatic incidents in the book. I mean, it seems like every 10 pages, somebody else was rolling into town and doing something. And Cuervo, for all you say, he's a shy guy. He shows up as a pretty brave individual in terms of dealing with all these things.
I would agree with that. He's cautious, and he's able to put his kind of pride aside, which makes him much more, as I said, calculated than some of his contemporaries. But it's true. I mean, I think of one of the major attacks on tequila that occurred on Cuervo's birthday. It was his 44th birthday in October of 1913. And when they get word that there's a revolutionary army that's on its way, headed toward the town, and all of the town fathers and all of the prominent families are gathered in one place at Cuervo's home, he very quickly springs into action. He has the women and children kind of taken to quarters where they can hide. He is wiring out to all of his agave properties outside of town, telling people to saddle up and come to town to defend the distillery. He's ready with weapons and ammunition in the barrel room of the distillery, and starts dispensing those goods to the people who are there to defend the village. And eventually, even when the head of the military, the federal military, persuades Cuervo and the other tequila makers that they are so outnumbered that they have to flee, even in the face of that, Cuervo insists that he wants, you know, to hide the weapons, to which he does by digging trenches in the stalls of the stable at the distillery. He wants to keep these weapons out of the hands of the people who want to do harm to the town. And so he's he is a fierce defender of his business and his home. But as you say, eventually there are so many forces rallied against him that there's nothing he can do other than just try to survive.
Yeah.
Which he does.
Yeah. Which he does. He made some alliances and. So as we finish up here, what would you say is Jose Cuervo's legacy?
Yeah, so I think the thing that Cuervo saw was that the way forward for his industry and really for his country was through alliances and working together and modernizing as opposed to these factional fights. And one irony is that the way that he imagined organizing and bringing his industry together was under a German model of business cooperation, which was called the cartel. And so the thing that Cuervo wanted, the peaceful solution that he was seeking that would allow everyone to divide up property and territory and set fixed prices that would eliminate competition, the peaceful model that he imagined, almost as soon as he died, all of the people who had been members of that cartel turn on each other and it becomes a cartel war.
Right, right. Very fascinating. So Ted Genovese, the book Tequila Wars. Ted, thank you very much for sharing the book with our listeners, and we'll be right back.
Each year, the Mountain West Capital Network releases a report on equity-related financial transactions in Utah. Here to share some of the highlights, we have Kevin Jessup, president of the Mountain West Capital Network, and Matt Bartholomew, the Deal Flow Chair. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for letting us join you.
So, let me start with you, Kevin. Can you share a bit about the Mountain West Capital Network and the Deal Flow Report? Why do you guys do this every year?
Mountain West Capital Network is Utah's premier business networking organization, focused on fostering capital formation, celebrating entrepreneurial success across the state. We connect entrepreneurs, investors, executives, and advisors through a variety of events and programs designed to support business growth here. The Deal Flow event in particular is my favorite. I think it's our marquee event because it gathers all of the information together to present to the state.
Okay, so Matt, let's start with some macro observations. I know we generally get to talk to you guys every year, but let's talk about macro observation in terms of the nature and quantity of this year's deal flow in comparison to prior years. Up, down, same, different, what do you say?
Yeah, it's been, as we look at the data, and as Kevin mentioned, we spend a lot of time grinding through and pulling together the data. And the data shows, for what's disclosed, that for the second straight year, Utah experienced over $30 billion in deal value for the second consecutive year. So that's very promising from 23 to 24. And then, but to your point, in terms of overall kind of volume, right, when we think about how many are happening out there across the state? We saw the highest level of deal volume, transaction volumes, and really driven by all the mergers and acquisition activity. So when you think about a new buyer coming in and taking control effectively of a company, that's what we usually refer to as a merger and acquisition deal that we look at. And that just about doubled, going from 120 in 2023 to 239 in 2024. And then we also saw in the public deals, as companies are looking to issue new securities through the public markets, that went from 5 to 11. And so at any rate, so overall deal volume at the highest level, with really driven, like I said, where sellers are acquiescing or giving ownership to new investors or individuals.
And I don't know if you're going to know the answer to this one, but do you have any sense of how that kind of growth pattern here in Utah compares with activities in other parts of the country?
Yeah, it's a good sense. I mean, it's a good question. In my role, I cover a variety of states throughout the Intermountain West, and I think it's definitely higher, and I think it really attributes to the kind of the diversity of of industry that we have here within the state. I mean, you just look broadly at you know, certain markets, you could say there are two or three industries that really drive those markets. I would say historically, obviously, you know, health, software and tech is a huge part of where Utah's gone, at least from a deal and transaction ecosystem perspective, and just the sheer amount of what's happening out there year to year. But we see a lot of services businesses, right? A lot of founder, owner, operators of businesses have found their opportunity in the insurance space, or wealth management, accounting and financial services. Also, we saw a lot in lube servicing, collision repair businesses, HVAC businesses, training and education businesses. The list goes on and on. Patient experience, involved improvement businesses. So there's a lot of what I would call a broader services sector that, accompanied by what's the tried and true on the software and tech side, that's really driven a lot of this activity that we saw in 2024 over 2023.
I think our listeners might be interested in hearing a little bit about how Summit County is represented in the deal book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a variety of both what I'll call acquirers, so to speak, or those that are investing into businesses, as well as those that have sold, as well as those receiving kind of a minority investment. And so just touching on those, you know, from an investor perspective, Prestige Holdings, that's in Summit County, in Park City, Mascoff Brennan, Summit Milling, Uinta Investment Partners, Backcountry, well-known business in Park City, the Orthopedic Partners went through a transaction in 2024. And then, as I mentioned, I mean, those that have received minority investments include Carbon Insurance Agency, excuse me, Everclear Equity AI, very fascinating business in Park City, Hope River Ranch, Pale Blue Earth, as well as Momentous. So those are specific businesses that are in and around the Park City area that that all went through a transaction in 2024.
That's a big range of different businesses.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then what about Wasatch County? Because we also have Wasatch County listeners.
Oh, I don't have a at least what I pulled together, I don't have a differentiation between Wasatch versus Summit. So apologies. Those that I read off, those 18 or 19 different businesses are kind of in that broader area, I would say.
So let's talk about, we talked a little bit about the range of businesses. Are you seeing you know, any kinds of new sort of types of businesses that are being more significant in terms of deal flow and in terms of presence in the Utah economy? You know, obviously 5 years ago, the words AI probably wouldn't be coming out of your mouth. What do you see as coming next, and what are we seeing the first signs of in terms of new kinds of businesses, if any?
Yeah, I mean, that's another great question. I think we see a lot of trends in what they call fintech, right? So technology surrounding kind of the financial sector. That's been a hot area over the last 2 years, I'd say, 2-3 years in Utah, as well as to your point about AI. I mean, so I want to say, I think last year, 2023, we saw investment in around 10 different companies focused on AI. I think that number was just above that in 2024. And you see these kind of practices are kind of what I call where maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago in Utah, you don't have as many acquirers, right? So larger companies buying up smaller companies, so to speak, to really kind of scale and grow in that fashion. And you see that now in Utah, where you have these services focused businesses, like I mentioned, especially in the insurance, wealth management, accounting, financial services spaces, that are kind of buying these practices from individual or partnerships that operate in that service, those services sector. So that's been a really big driver, especially over the last, I'd call it 18 to 24 months.
Yeah. Now, how's Utah doing with manufacturing?
Yeah, I would say it's doing well. I mean, I would say when you talk about that space of manufacturing distribution, I would say there's definitely more on the distribution side, because I think there's a lot of tech enablement and kind of tech focused solutions on that size of, hey, how can I deliver X package to this business or individual faster than the competitors across the nation? So that's been a big focus in the broader manufacturing distribution area. But I think of companies ranging from from Davis County through through Utah County. So there's definitely, I would need to dig into it further, but there's definitely activity out there. It's not like it's a space that has struggled at all. If anything, it's done well. And I would say one highlight in particular, talking to our tax people here at CLA, like one part of this bill that they're looking to pass that they're working through, it really provides a lot of credits and incentives in bringing manufacturing further back to the U.S. and or further doubling down in a lot of the manufacturing facilities. I mean, these are pretty interesting incentives that are within the current draft of the bill. But at any rate, so I would expect, if that bill passes in some form, that we'll see further investment. But manufacturing has done well. I would say it's just not kind of a key driver in an overall profile of what we see across the state.
And I flipped through the deal book and was looking at some of the public offerings. And one of the larger ones was one here in Park City called EQV Ventures, which I take it is a SPAC. So can you explain a little bit about what that means and what these people might be doing?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just, it comes down to where that office might be. So to your point, EQ Ventures located, again, it really comes down to just
right. Kind
of almost a formality of an address location. That's just another way for capital investment to be out there, kind of parked in a vehicle whereby when those that are driving that kind of that investment vehicle find the right business, it allows that investment dollars to combine with that business. So in this case, so to your point, that looks like they completed about $350 million business. So again, usually what you think about it is like, it's almost like a back office. So you have those that are looking to be management or part of that board team, so to speak, to really help drive the nature of the acquisition that they're looking to do.
Yeah, those are really interesting because you're going to the public and saying, I want you to invest in me, when the underlying business may not necessarily be clear as to what I'm really investing in.
you're right. I mean, it is kind of a unique vehicle that allows for kind of what I would call more of a speedily deployment of capital, right? You get that set up. You have a management team and investors that are actively discussing what the thesis is around what they're looking to invest in. And then to your point, further down the road, being able to complete that. So I would say, within SPACs, to your point, these special purpose acquisition companies, it's, you don't see them as much as you did two or three years ago. So I'd say that this is definitely unique.
Yeah. Okay. So what are your thoughts about the implications of this report for the future of business activities here in Utah?
Yeah, I think we love getting involved in pulling together the report and in being able to broadcast this to the broader community, because as I mentioned in my own role, I span different states, I see different things. There's nothing akin that I've seen to what we have here in the Deal Flow Report. And I think it just shows both the capital providers that are here in the state really kind of profiling what they're doing and the activity ranging from the independent sponsors, venture capital community, private equity community, and how vibrant that is here in Utah, definitely punching above its weight, so to speak, from a population size perspective. But also the great bit of work that underlies it from an entrepreneurial perspective, the amount of capital that they've put at risk in starting businesses that have a full range that is very diverse relative to most of the metro areas in the broader Intermountain West, and even ranging all the way down to Texas, I would say. So I think 2025 will be interesting. I mean, obviously there's tariffs, there's a lot of other kind of uncertainty out there. So I would say broadly, as I work in the deal space, I see more scrutiny being applied and just a little more time being taken in terms of understanding how the different, whether it's tax policy, tariffs, other questions that may not have been as relevant a year ago, or just being sorted out. Getting the deal done is taking longer. So you could see a modest step down in 2025 just because of the sheer amount of work that's being done to make sure buyers and sellers are both comfortable in doing the transaction. So we love being part of this process, and it's fascinating to see, but I don't see momentum really slowing down significantly. At least my team is as busy right now as we were a year ago.
Okay, we've been speaking with Kevin Jessup and Matt Bartholomew of the Mountain West Capital Network about this year's New Deal report. Thanks for spending time with us this morning. We'll be right back after this.
If my memory serves me, it's been some time since we had a new restaurant open on Main Street, Park City. Now we have not just one, but two new places to eat in Old Town. Le Depot and Union Patisserie. Did I get those right, guys?
Pretty good.
Right on. Okay, joining us this morning to tell us about both restaurants are Galen and Katie Zamara. Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. Looks like you brought us some wonderful samples to try. So if you hear silence, you don't have to adjust your radio. It's just Roger and I eating some of these yummy treats. Now, can you give us a brief description of each restaurant, you know, the hours, seating capacity, square footage, et cetera, you know, the nuts and bolts of that?
Sure. So let's start with Le Depot Brasserie. Mm-hmm. That's our French brasserie restaurant. We're open for lunch, brunch on the weekends, dinner. So, and we generally have a continual service. So we start lunch or brunch at 11:30 a.m. and we serve until 4:30 p.m. And then from 4:30 until 5:30, we keep our bar menu open, a little bit smaller, sampling burgers and some snacks and so forth. And then 5:30, we start dinner until 9:30.
Good. And that's Le Depot
Brasserie.
Yeah.
Yes.
The L-E is, I want to say Le, but...
Well, everybody says Le.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's Le.
Now, so Union Patisserie is right behind.
Right behind it, yep. And so Union Patisserie is our coffee and pastry shop. A little more than that, we might call it a wine bar too. We have a wine and beer license. So it's a place you can come in and get your pastries, coffees, breakfasts. We have lunch dishes and we have some fun French savory things, you know, like duck rillette or some fun sardines, cheese charcuterie, stuff like that, with a very simple beer and wine offering. And then we also have sweets, desserts, macaroons. We're starting our ice cream soon. Mm-hmm. Everything made in-house.
Now, is this something, is the Union Patisserie a place where if I have, let's say I have dinner somewhere else on Main Street, but I don't want their dessert, I want to come down there. Is it open later?
Yeah, we're open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. there.
Oh, okay, so yeah. It wouldn't be an after dinner pop in for your dessert and a...
Not unless you're early.
Yeah, if you're early. Yeah. If you're early. But yeah, but you know, you can also come down to Le Depot for dessert later too, because we have our same pastry chef who's overseeing everything, so...
And who's that?
Cassidy Cabal.
Nice.
So tell us a little bit about your career journey. How did the two of you end up doing this? How did you get there from here, or here from there? Go ahead, Katie.
I'll start. So Galen and I met in New York. My background's hospitality. I grew up in New Orleans and went to hotel and restaurant school. And then career path took me to New York, where I met Galen. So we were in New York City for 22 years.
Woo-hoo.
And then we moved to Park City for Galen to open the lodge at Blue Sky. And then the opportunity came up with the Le Depot and Union, that plaza there, to do restaurants in there. And Galen's background is a restaurateur. We were super excited to go to work and have our place on Main Street as a restaurant. And Le Depot, too, I'll just back up. The name came from, it's the train station. So it used to be Park City's train station. And that's where we came up with the name in French, of course. And then Union Patisserie, the courtyard there was called Union Square. So that's where the name Union came from for that. And that's how we met, and this is how this is formed.
Yeah, we met Katie doing marketing and PR as well, and a mutual friend of ours. It was while I was building a restaurant I had in Manhattan called Moss Farmhouse. And while that was under construction, a mutual friend of ours, actually two brothers, really great bar chefs, guys out of New York, opened a place in the North Fork of Long Island, and Katie was doing some PR for them, and I helped them design a little simple menu for their bar, and that's how we first met. And we've been working together, and now we have our own hospitality group that we're partners in.
So tell us a little bit about the evolution of your cooking style. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, what is the, to the extent we could talk about a philosophy around the French food that you're serving. How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, for me, I grew up in Santa Cruz, California.
I didn't hear a French accent, so.
Yeah.
He can turn it on.
I grew up in Santa Cruz, California, which reminds me a lot of Park City in the sense it's just a place you just always want to be outdoors. Mm-hmm. Santa Cruz unique, though, is right at the top of, you know, that sort of the big valley of California where almost all of the food in this country comes from. But it's also all the big ag stuff. So there was a lot of horrors of seeing how that stuff was grown. And Santa Cruz, being a very progressive town, is very interested. Even back, you know, 70s and 80s, growing up, was involved in all the, you know, sustainability and stuff. So that's always been a big part of my life. I moved to New York to go to culinary school and work in some of the top places there. And found some home with the chef David Boulay, who was also not known for it, but because he didn't really like broadcast it, but was also very involved with more, it was less from a sustainability point, it was a point of quality of working direct with farmers. So that's why I really found a home in there. So that part's always been a part of my evolution. To be honest, it's a little less of it here that we're doing at Le Depot Brasserie. And I'll be quite frank, it's not that things aren't totally available, but what I found when we were at Lodge at Blue Sky, especially in the wintertime here, there's not a lot of available product with the local farms. There's a poor infrastructure that is growing here for those great food things, and it's really right now, farmers markets opens up, there's all these local farms doing stuff, it's nice, but there's about 8 months of the year where that's harder. I don't have a French accent. Funny enough, my family, we were living in Courchevel, France, when my mother was pregnant with me. They went to Switzerland just for the birth. So I was born in Geneva, Switzerland. We lived in Courchevel. I moved to the United States when I was about 6 months old. But it's an American family. I did go back to France in the early 90s for 2 years and worked in some of the top 3 Michelin star restaurants around France, mostly in Paris, and loved it. So I have a real affinity for French cuisine. And also David Boulay, the chef that I mentioned earlier, was a French chef, and so that's really where I spent a lot of my time. So I love it. That's where most of my training comes from. And so that's kind of why, I mean, we also felt like these concepts there's not much in the Park City area for them. And so we thought they would work well.
Now, I know a lot of people speak about, well, I can't get a croissant like I can get one, you know, when I was traveling in France. Do you have that there now? I mean, this croissant just brought us.
You know? Yes, we do. So you know what the big thing is it's buying the right, well, first, the most thing is a lot of work. So you have to be willing to make them yourself versus buying, what I think most places do is they buy pre-made frozen ones and they bake them off.
Yeah.
Rather, because it requires a lot of equipment and a lot of space and then skill.
The skill, so, of butter between each
of laminating layer. The dough, yes. Yeah. It's quite a process.
Yeah.
And in general, you need a big sheeter, which wouldn't even fit on this desk. They're big. You need a special oven. You need proofing cabinets. You need a lot. People don't want to do all that. A lot of places. Something you're selling for a few dollars. So
yeah. You take a bite out of that croissant and you can just feel the difference, the texture, the flavor. It bursts between the layers.
Yes.
It's like that.
You can taste the love and the work that was put into it. I mean, I'm not, you know, this is, this is very, very tasty. But so speaking of the time and the energy it takes put into that, how many man hours would you say per croissant?
Oh, gosh.
Or point, whatever. If you could, point one, I mean,
just making the dough alone is a process because one of the, you know, so what leavens a croissant, unlike in other breads, it's not yeast or, you know, anything, it's the butter. And so one of the things when you're laminating it, meaning you're folding it in layer after layer after layer after layer. So every time you open a croissant, you see all those little layers. That was a fold where butter was in between. And one of the things is you have to keep the butter cold the whole time. So you can do a little bit of it and then you refrigerate it, a little bit more, mm-hmm. refrigerate it, because if the butter starts to melt, it will all fall apart and it won't work right. So there's just, it's just many hours of that. And then it's rolling them out, forming them, proofing them, baking them. So, I mean, it's over multiple days.
Yeah.
And we have chocolate croissants. We have almond croissants.
Is that pistachio?
Pistachio roll that's similar to a cinnamon roll. And then the Queen of Moms have been really popular.
You know, I want to go back to the restaurant for just a minute. And one of the things that people complain about on Main Street is that the prices are so high. I look at the price point you guys have selected, and it's pretty, you know, moderate, particularly for Main Street. How do you do it?
I'm glad that you noted it because I think that's a big, this is a lot of what we heard, and we live here. We know that as well. Park City is an expensive town. We know that. We know that real estate is expensive. We know that, I don't know if everybody knows this, but just to give you a point, in a state where minimum wage is under $8 an hour, we are paying dishwashers more like $20 an hour. So it's, that's the expense. But the concept of a brasserie is that it's just this part of the community. It's this traditional French food that people know, but the big key is that's this part of the community, and that's really what we want. And you know, we're in the Zoom space, and I think everybody familiar with Zoom, I think Zoom was that
for
the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
So really that's that's a goal. 10 years from now, we can look back and hope that we've achieved that same sort of thing. So I think that was an important part of it. People have been loving it. But I don't want a restaurant that's something for everything because I think that's a mistake. But you can come in, and we have main courses that are under $30. If you want to blow it out, Seafood Tower, caviar, big filet mignon. Mm-hmm. Like, we have an amazing list of champagnes and wines. You can blow it out and have an amazing time. But I also want it to be a place that people know. Come, have a burger, some beers at the bar, hang out. You don't need to spend, you know, you can come in very often, and we want it to be that way.
And today we're starting prefix lunch.
Oh.
So two courses, $27, or three courses, $32.
Nice.
Yeah,
will the menu be up on the web so people can see it?
We will get it up there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We have to go. Thank you to Galen and Katie Zamara. Thanks for spending time with us this morning, and thanks especially for these marvelous pastries.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For having
Thank
us
you.
In.
All right. We'll be right back after this.